Is there anyone in church this morning who likes the month of January? No? Doesn't have much going for it, does it? The high point is New Year's Eve, which is actually in December, and all we do is celebrate the tearing of a page off the calendar. And unless you're a Scot looking forward to Burns Night, the next big event is Lent, and that's 2 months away on the 6th of March this year. Oh yes, I have ignored St. Valentine's Day. This has been the week when we have to face the task of packing up the Christmas decorations, recycling the present packaging, getting used to bare buildings, short days, low temperatures, and being back at work. It even comes to us at church, because after the anticipation of Advent and the celebration of Christmas, the building is bare, and we need to get back to some serious Bible study. And so we are starting returning to our studies on the book of Isaiah. Little bit of recapitulation to remind us where we've got to. The style of Isaiah's prophecy changes between chapter 39, which we looked at before our weekend away in October, yes, that long ago, and chapter 40, which we read this morning. We should remember that the Bible was not written with chapter divisions as we have today, still less the headings used in the New International Version. Oh, sorry. I've gone offline. Still less the headings we've used in the New International Version. The text is continuous, and the earliest manuscripts move seamlessly from chapter 39, where King Hezekiah showed his potential enemies everything he had, the plunder they would take when they conquered Jerusalem, to chapter 40, which starts with a call to take comfort. The change in content and style is so marked that some commentators have suggested that they were written by different authors. Now, I'm not going to rehearse that debate this morning, but Isaiah chapters 40 to 55 are collectively known as the Servant Songs, and the significance of this for us is that they work at two levels. Isaiah was speaking to his contemporaries and his immediate successors in captivity, but the songs also speak to us, the people of the New Testament era. And the connection is so strong that this section of Isaiah is often called the Old Testament Gospel. To understand our passage, we need to remind ourselves of the background. The Kingdom of Israel was established by King David, as you'll remember. It reached its zenith with the construction of the temple under Solomon. And then there were a succession of kings, some of whom were faithful to God and others of whom rejected him. Overall, the trend was downwards, and God became increasingly angry at their faithlessness in leading his people. By the time of Isaiah, some punishment was due, and God administered it through the rising power of the Assyrian Empire. King Ahaz was leading Israel at the time, and when an invasion became imminent, he expected that the Assyrians would lay siege to Jerusalem. So being a good strategist, he realised that in an arid country, it was important to secure the water supply to the city, and that so that it could withstand the siege, and if possible, to deny water supplies to his enemy. It was while he was doing this at the upper pool that he encountered Isaiah, who challenged him by asking him whether he would meet the threat of his nation himself by alliances with other nations or by trusting in the Lord. He chose the path of self-reliance and entered into a treaty with Syria. Well, the Assyrians duly attacked and were successful. Ahaz was killed and most of the kingdom was occupied, with the exception of Judah and Jerusalem. Ahaz was succeeded by King Hezekiah, who duly faced the same threat and was about to adopt the same strategy. He then met with Isaiah at the upper pool and was presented with the same challenge, to face the conflict in his own strength or to trust in God. He decided to trust in the Lord. The Assyrians duly laid siege to the city, and even though the position was beginning to look difficult, Hezekiah stayed firm. However, the food and water supplies were running out, and he sought reassurance from Isaiah, that things were going, that the Lord was going to be able to be trusted. And Isaiah responded that within 24 hours the price of food would collapse. And so it was. That night some lepers outside the city gates went scavenging in the Assyrian camp and discovered it was deserted. The mighty army had taken to its heels and fled. The siege was lifted and the people could plunder the abandoned stores of the Assyrians. We not only have the biblical account of these events, but also the reports of Assyrian historians who recount that the army experienced illness that caused them to withdraw. Hezekiah had trusted in God and received his blessing and enjoyed security for his kingdom in his lifetime. But Isaiah warned at the end of chapter 39 that there was a penalty still to be paid for the sins of his predecessors. Following Hezekiah's death, Babylon conquered Assyria, so there was a takeover of Assyria, and then Assyria moved on to take over Israel. And as a consequence of that conquest, most of the inhabitants of Jerusalem, including another familiar name, a young man called Daniel, were enslaved and taken away. Isaiah chapter 40 is the start of a prophecy in which God intended to be a comfort to his people during the long years in exile. It contains the promise that they will return to Jerusalem. It also addresses a warning contained in chapter 7 of Isaiah, in verse 9, where God says, "If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all." So how did God assure his people that he cared for them? And does that imply that he cares for us? Turn back to page 724 in your Bible and we'll see what Isaiah's prophecy teaches us. We start with verses 1 and 2, obviously. And these two offer the promise to the exiles. The exiles, of course, were a conquered people who'd been taken 900 miles and 4 months' journey from their homes to where they now were. They were suffering oppression and injustice. The exile would last for decades, and in the midst of their hard labour, it would be natural for them to despair and to give up all hope that they would ever return to their homeland. Worse than that, they'd been separated from the country that was being promised to them by God when they were last in captivity in Egypt. The conquest and exile undermined their trust and faith in God, as well as separating them from all that was familiar. They were a short step from losing faith in God himself. The message from Isaiah was that they would not be banished forever. In time, the penalty of their sin and faithfulness would be paid, and they would be able to return home. God was punishing his people, but he was not abandoning them, and one day the debt would be paid. There is hope for the future. Prophecy, of course, is not only about the leadership sin of Judah. It points to the need to address the wider issue of sin that affects all humankind. All of us, including you and me, are inherently sinful, and our relationship with God is as broken as that of the exiles. The promise to the exiles was that their sin would be completely covered by forgiveness, and that the same is true for us when Jesus bore our punishment for sin at Calvary. Verses 3 to 5 are a call to prepare for the coming of the Lord. In the south of France, there's a huge limestone plateau about 3,000 feet high called the Massif Central. Now, I would have brought that into a sermon, wouldn't I? One of the small towns in the area is called Milo. For centuries, there's been a bridge there across the River Tarn, which drains the area. The valley is in a depression about 1,000 feet deep. So travellers wanting to use the bridge had to make their way down into the valley, cross it, and then climb out to continue on their way. In 2004, a bypass was completed to carry the motorway between Paris and the Mediterranean past the town. It not only eliminated the congestion, but also the tedious descent to the river by the provision of a viaduct about 1.5 miles long and 1,000 feet high, higher than the Eiffel Tower. So high that under certain weather conditions, you can travel across on a road and see the cloud in the valley below. And this is the image of verses 3 to 5. Not that God was going to lead another, or there was going to be another exodus of people, but because God was going to come and meet them and join them in the desert and come to their aid. The idea is making way is that of a processional route, broad, level, straight and smooth, for a journey without difficulty and a certain arrival. To the exiles, it's the prospect that God would retake control of their situation and reassert his promises to them. In fact, he never surrendered control, but his people needed to put their sin behind them and rebuild their relationship with him. This would be a new beginning at the end of their exile. This time of year, it's appropriate to remember that God did, of course, enter Jerusalem in the person of Jesus, but not quite in the manner expressed in the prophecy. First time Jesus entered Jerusalem was as humble as it gets, an eight-day-old baby in his mother's arms. Even when he entered to make his final conquest, it was not as a conquering hero at the head of an army, but riding on a donkey. He didn't come to conquer, but to sacrifice, and to found a new kingdom based on love, reconciliation, and humility. Continuing to verses 6 to 8, we're presented with the contrast between human transience and divine permanence. Now, you can compare this with our relationship to our pets. When they come into the world, we're there. They spend all their lives with us, and we're the reliable provider for all their needs. We feed them, we shelter them, we provide care for them when they're ill. And then they die. To us, we are eternal. We're there throughout the whole of their lives. They never know anything else. Similarly for us, God existed before the creation of the universe and will be there when it ends. Isaiah affirms that God will certainly keep and perform the promises that he makes to us during that period. And the promise to the exiles is that the domination of the Babylonians would come to an end. Now, being human, the Babylonians would soon, in God's timescale, wither and die. Like the grass in the field, they would pass into history. The exiles could anticipate their return, but would associate it with the demise of the Babylonian Empire. They could not anticipate that God would actually harness the power and resources of pagan Babylon to deliver his promises. The exile ended when Babylonian King Cyrus the Liberator not only allowed the exiles to return, but instructed his regional officials to help them rebuild Jerusalem. God is not subject to human constraints and human loyalties. He achieves his will through faithful and unfaithful alike. When we seek to do his will, we have more strength and impact with him than we can know or imagine when we trust the Lord. There's no timidity or self-censorship in verses 9 to 11. The Lord is coming to look after his people as a shepherd looks after his flock, and is to be proclaimed not just from the rooftops, but from the high mountains. He will exercise his detailed personal care and use his sovereign power to force his way through a trackless desert. Nothing can resist his advance. It's an image of power and might. It's being used with discrimination in a measured way that's appropriate to the need and circumstance of the time. The announcement is of the succession of a new kingdom. The Jewish exiles would have given it their interpretation with a political objective, the restoration of descendants of King David to the throne in Jerusalem. They expected the use of the military force to achieve a political goal, much as David had done in years before. But verse 11 points to something very different. A kingdom where the king leads as a shepherd providing love and care for his flock. It's a kingdom where the inhabitants are respected and valued, not despised, oppressed or exploited. Isaiah is not looking to a rebuilt Jerusalem, but a new Jerusalem, the kingdom of God. So to sum up then, the central question that verses 1 to 11 raises, are you going to trust God? The vision has been set before us. For the exiles, it was whether they would trust God sufficiently in the midst of exile, slavery and oppression to sustain their faith until the day when the power of Babylon had abated and they could return home. It meant maintaining their loyalty, culture and traditions in the face of the work of discrimination of a conqueror who despised them. Years of hard graft, not knowing when the relief would actually come and how it would occur. Isaiah held out the prospect, but the people accept the promise and live day by day in faith that it will come sometime. We can look at these verses with the benefit of hindsight. We have seen the fulfillment of the prophecies. We know that the Jews were allowed to return home. We know that Israel, the punishment of Israel's sin was completed, but it didn't get to the heart of the problem. Look at verse 3 again. You read, in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord. And in verse 5, the glory of the Lord will be revealed. Verses 9 and 10, say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes in power. Isaiah is celebrating the power of God, which is completed in Jesus. The prophecies became a verifiable fact. And so have the prophecies of the coming of Jesus become verified and historical. For us, the challenge is, do you trust in God, and believe in your heart that Jesus came not as a man, but as God, to initiate this new kingdom, the kingdom of heaven? Verses 12 to 25 ask us to contemplate some of the characteristics of the God who was calling us to trust him. Verse 12 looks to the creation to attempt to measure the scale of who he is. Look at the statements there, beginning, who is? In verse 12, he holds the waters in his hands. How much water can you hold in the palm of your hand? Well, I did an experiment, not a very scientific one, and I found that I could hold about a teaspoonful in my hand. So God's hands are rather bigger than mine. Isaiah says that God can hold all the water on the earth, or the dust of the earth. Think about how much dust there is. I'm sure that as you removed those Christmas decorations, you discovered that there was a layer of dust that had formed after only 2 or 3 weeks. Well, that's insignificant as far as God's concerned. Imagine the size of the scales that you would need to weigh the mountains. This God, our God, is enormous. Verses 13 and 14 take a different focus. No human being can understand God's spirit or give him advice, teach him or enlighten him. His knowledge and power are outside our comprehension. God asked Job 52 questions that he could not answer in order to teach him how little he actually knew. As individuals, we feel insignificant. Among the 80,000 people in Stevenage, still less among the 60 million in the British Isles. But Isaiah says that all the nations, billions of us, are but a drop in a bucket by God's standards. When you fill a bucket with water, do you notice the effect of adding the last drop? I don't. Our Creator God cannot be reproduced in an image or an idol. He's simply too big for us to conceive what he's like. Think of an ant walking across your garden. At its level, it's like walking through a forest, and each blade of grass represents an obstacle to be overcome. The ant has no concept of how big the lawn is, still less that there are flower borders round it or a house beside it or a fence beyond that. Its horizons are limited by its size and what's in the way. In the same manner, we are restricted in our perception of God. He was and is the sole deity, wise beyond our understanding, the creator and guarantor of all his promises to us. And the section ends with the climax in verse 25, which is a challenge to the exiles and to ourselves. One of the temptations for all of us is to adopt the practices of those around us. For the exiles, it was the Babylonians and their worship of the stars. For us, it's all the culture that invades us day by day. Given what we've heard of the greatness of God, are we still tempted to practice idolatry or to worship the creation rather than the creator? Or like me, do you live in awe of this enormous, powerful God who made the whole created order? Do you feel you can trust him? Do you think you can trust the promises of God? Isaiah is encouraging you and me to do so. We must press on to the conclusion. Verses 26 to 31 pose the questions: does God really know his people and does he care? Can our way on earth become so tangled that God loses sight of us? Underlying this is the feeling there's no use in pleading our cause before God only for it to be dismissed out of hand. We don't go to court unless we have a hope of winning. Verse 26 reminds us that it's God's power and strength that sustains creation, and nothing in his creation is missing. While verse 28 goes on to say that God is everlasting, so there's never a time when he's absent. He's creator. To the ends of the earth, there is nowhere outside of his knowledge and understanding. God will not grow tired or weary, so his strength does not flag. And unlike us, he's not limited by inner resources. His understanding is complete, so perception is not a constraint. He really does care about us, and our ways cannot become so tangled that he loses sight of us. Isn't that a huge encouragement as we set out on a new year? Whatever happens, God knows about it and cares for us as we walk in his way. And as the chapter concludes, we receive a huge reassurance, especially for those like me who are in advancing years. With all their strength and energy, young men still grow tired and run out of stamina. But God has no such restrictions. He can renew us, and we can move in his strength rather than our own. Prophecy of Isaiah is that the exile would end and be fulfilled, and Jerusalem would be restored with a rebuilt temple. There was a physical exile, but the real exile that we all experience is separation from God as a consequence of sin. It was not resolved until John the Baptist began his ministry in the desert and proclaimed, as Isaiah had forecast, the coming of the Lord in human form as Jesus. Jesus finally gave our limited human minds a way of seeing and understanding the nature and heart of God. He perfectly displayed the love and care of his Father for his people. During his life, he understood and addressed the deepest practical and spiritual needs of those who met him. Think, for example, of his encounters with the woman at the well, the blind beggar, or the woman caught in adultery. Think of the Sermon on the Mount, or the feeding of the 5,000, when Jesus met the needs of large groups of people, teaching, healing, and feeding them. He was concerned and provided for their needs in love and compassion. Jesus filled the gulf between men and God by dying at Calvary, once and for all. We cannot experience the joy of being in his immediate physical presence, but we can share the closeness of God in our own lives by trusting him. Here is our God, mighty and caring. Do you have hope in him?